Going back to when Canned Heat sort of got together, can you give us a little bit of an idea about how the band got together and when you started enjoying some success?
It's been quite a struggle and quite an uphill battle. But let's start with the history. The band started in late 1965 or early 66 and was founded by Alan Christie Wilson and Robert Height. Alan Wilson, known as the Blind Owl, and Height, known as the Bear. They had several different lineups with different musicians until the first more or less recognizable lineup came in with Henry Vestine on the guitar, Larry Taylor on the bass, and Frank Cook on the drums. That's the band that recorded the first record. And I came into the band in late 1967. My first gig with Canned Heat was actually playing with The Doors in UCLA on December 1st, 1967. And from then on, the whole adventure started. I joined the band. To me, it was a great privilege and a great thing that happened in my life, probably the best thing that happened in my life. And we went on, and finally in 1967 and in 68, we recorded the Boogie with Canned Heat album, which contained On the Road Again, the original version, not the Willie Nelson version, the original On the Road Again that we did, and it became quite a big hit in Texas. It broke in Texas to start with, and then it became a hit all over the world, and that was the beginning of our great adventure.
Fido, how did you come to join the band? What were you doing prior to that, and how did that kind of come together?
Well, I'm originally from Mexico City, and I started playing drums since I was about 12 years old. I've been extremely lucky that I never had to do anything else except playing drums. And even down in Mexico, I was doing quite well. I played with some of the most famous bands there. Mexico City had its own subculture of rock and rollers there. You know, it's a big city with 20 million people, and we were able to work and have cafe cantantes and coffee houses and all that. And we were copying rock and roll from the United States, of course. You know, I guess Mexico was the second country where rock and roll music was played. I went to see Bill Haley and Jerry Lee Lewis, and I just got fell in love with this music. And shortly after, this guy Javier Batiz came to Mexico and turned us on to rhythm and blues music and to the blues. He was also Carlos Santana's first teacher. You know, he showed Carlos his first chords. Javier came and brought that influence, that black music, into Mexico City. And from then onwards, I really fell in love with that kind of music, and my dream to come to the United States and play that kind of music, it started hearing in my head. And eventually, I married an American girl and came here in 1966 and was, as I said, very happy and very lucky to join Canned Heat in 67.
A lot of people relate the music Canned Heat and just other music contemporary back to like the Monterey Pop Festival and that era. What do you remember from that particular event as being sort of instrumental? Was it sort of a launching of the group into a larger audience?
Yes, absolutely. The group enjoyed also, they had a great performance. I was not in the band at the time of the Monterey Pop Festival, but I do know that they were on the cover of Downbeat magazine, and they got a great review from Pete Welding. That was the beginning not only of the movement of the whole renaissance of the late 60s music, you know, a fantastic movement of music, but it was also the beginning for Canned Heat to get recognition.
Skip, early in Canned Heat, when they were growing and finding their way, I guess there's a story about a club called the Family Dog in Denver that may have been a seminal moment in the band's growing pains, if you will. Is there something you can talk about?
Hello?
Skip? Yeah, did you hear that?
Yeah, I did hear you. Yeah. The Family Dog was one of Chet Helms's clubs. He also had the Family Dog in the Avalon Ballroom in San Francisco. And at the time, even before that, I was an agent at the William Morris Agency, started the rock and roll department there, and used to book bands with Chet Helms as well as Bill Graham, who had the Fillmore in San Francisco, and kind of didn't have a favorite. And when the Family Dog started in Denver, one of the few places to play outside of San Francisco this type of music, bands without record deals, without hit records, that were just drawing the underground FM radio crowd, Canned Heat played the Family Dog in Denver. Also, you had mentioned Monterey Pop. That was at a time when I was just starting with my partner John Hartman and Gary Essert. We were starting a club called the Kaleidoscope, which was modeled after the Avalon and the Fillmore in Los Angeles. And at the time, we had Canned Heat play Monterey through the graces of Lou Adler, who had the Mamas and Papas, and Johnny Rivers, and Scott McKenzie, lots of other people that he was involved with, and he was the one who really started the Monterey Pop Festival. And when we played the Family Dog in Denver, unfortunately, we had an incident there where there was a plant of marijuana from an old friend of Bob Heights for all the way back to when he had gone to high school there. And we all got arrested and eventually had to hire a high-profile attorney and put up bail. And the only way we could get money at that time was to sell the other half of our publishing, which, who knew, down the road, our publishing would become worth literally millions of dollars, and we don't have any of it.
Oh, wow.
And so when we hear a commercial today, like the Geico commercial with Going Up the Country, is the most played commercial, has been now for 26 weeks in America, and we get no royalties from that.
Wow.
Boy, that's got to
hurt. We are involved in a legal situation, which will come to a head later this year, where we are attempting to get back at least half of our publishing and maybe all of the ownership of our masters, which have now been sold by EMI, who purchased Liberty Records and Capitol Records, and EMI has now split up into split their ownership of masters and publishing to Sony ATV and Warner Brothers, and we are making a real push to finally rectify some of this. We don't know if it will happen or not.
Well, good luck on that, man.
Thank you.
Moving ahead, just the other iconic moment back at that time was Woodstock, where Canned Heat was. What do you remember back from there, again, as it was important to the band? Fito, let's ask you that.
Well, I mean, my story of Woodstock, that's the question I get asked to the most, and that's the reason why I wrote a book.
Right.
Actually, in my book, Living the Blues, I tell up my whole story from the moment I woke up until the moment I went to sleep.
On that day?
I cannot tell you the whole story on this interview, but I can tell you one of the funny moments, for example, is when we were waiting for a helicopter to try to arrive to the show because it was impossible to get there driving.
Right.
So we ended up in this little airport in White Hills, New York, you know, waiting for hours there. I remember I'd lie down on the pavement there on the asphalt and try to get some sleep while I was waiting. Because we had played the night before, too, and at the Fillmore East. So this helicopter shows up, and some of your colleagues from the press run to the helicopter and jump in. So we run after them. And the bear, you know, the big bear, and we are all these rowdy hippies, you know, coming to the helicopter, and the people from the press are already there. So Bob goes and says, "So you guys are going there?" You know, he said, the guy in the press goes, "Yes, we're going to report the news." So Bob grabs the little guy and hurls him out of the helicopter, just gets him out of the helicopter and tells him, "No, we are going there, and we're going to make the news. So that was really something that we actually hijacked a helicopter from the press, and we got all your colleagues out of there. They didn't want to mess with us. We looked too rowdy for them to mess with us, you know, a bunch of rowdy hippies. And that was the moment when, you know, we took that helicopter, we went above the festival, and right before we landed, we saw our roadies driving in on the truck with all the equipment. Hmm. And it was an amazing feat they did, because we finished the night before at 3 o'clock in the morning in New York City. They had to drive all the way from 3 o'clock to about 4 p.m., you know, more than 12 hours they drove without getting any sleep, and they actually made it with the instruments. And that's why I always kind of give some respect and recognition to the roadies. All over the world, I think the roadies are the infantry of rock and roll.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they certainly have a heavy lift every night. So yeah, now you
get recognition from all the rock stars that think they are too arrogant to, you know, give a thanks to the roadies. I always thank them, and I always think that our lives depend on them.
Yeah, well, they make you sound good and look good up there. So when you got on stage then, what do you remember about the actual gig, the actual playing in front of all those folks?
Well, Skip could fill you in on that, because Skip was the reason why we went on the stage at such a great hour. Skip has always believed that the best time to go on is at sunset. And we were one of the few bands that actually had all our equipment there available, you know, and all our members. So,
and we had the number one record on the whole East Coast at that moment.
That's right. Going up the country was basically
number one up and down the whole Eastern Seaboard, and yet the people that were there, 400,000 people, didn't really know who Canned Heat was. Had never seen the band, because we'd played very few gigs on the East Coast at that particular time. And so when we came on the stage following a band that...
The Incredible what was the name of that? Band from England.
Yeah.
And that's the band we followed. They were really soft and nice.
Very low-key, and there was no excitement. But the sun was setting, and it was a magical time. And when Canned Heat came on there, 400,000 people rose up out of the rain and the mud, and it was truly the most magical moment that I've ever experienced in my lifetime, period.
Oh, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, that's a great memory. Fido, I mean, how much of a launch was that? Where was Canned Heat? You mentioned they had the number one song up and down the East Coast, so obviously the band was enjoying success. Was Woodstock more of a launching point after that?
Well, Woodstock had a lot to do with our success worldwide, because the festival itself became an icon,
right,
for everybody to recognize, you know, the musical revolution. But
let me say one thing here.
On the road again, and also Going Up the Country had just come up, and Going Up the Country is really not dedicated to Woodstock, but it does fit Woodstock perfect, because you're going up the country when you're going to the Catskill Mountains, where Woodstock is. So the idea is that you're driving or going or hiking or whatever, going up the country from New York, you see. That's the whole thing.
And Skip, Let me say one thing also,
that Woodstock, when the movie came out, Canned Heat was in the original cut, as was Jefferson Airplane. And Warner Brothers, who owned the movie and owned the rights, decided they wanted to play it five times a day instead of four times a day at Grauman's Chinese in Los Angeles for the opening. And in so doing, they had to eliminate 12 minutes from the original film. The 12 minutes became Canned Heat and Jefferson Airplane getting cut because they were non-Warner Brothers acts.
Wow.
Politics,
and,
oh my goodness.
And I can tell you that instance, as much as the Denver bust, was another major disappointment for the band and another financial woe as well, you know.
Yeah.
It was the only time in the whole film where you would see an interaction between the audience and the band, where one of these guys, a guy that we had was a fan from Texas, climbed the wall, jumped the gap from the wall to the stage, and was returning a vest of Bob Heitz that he had caught in an event in Texas, and was returning this vest, this leather vest, to Bob. And Michael Wadley, who filmed the entire event, captured this so beautifully. And if you see the follow-up film of Woodstock,
that came out later.
Yeah, it just it was a real iconic moment. And if that had remained in the original film, as other bands that did remain in there, whether it be 10 years after or whomever, did get much more recognition worldwide, and Canned Heat would have gotten a lot more as well if that their portion had remained in the original movie.
Is the longer cut of the film out now, or is that available, or is it lost?
Yes, there is such thing as the director's cut that has included the Canned Heat performance, plus other people that got cut off. I mean, I believe there is some Janis Joplin stuff that got cut off, and Paul Butterfield also.
Yeah.
The Paul Butterfield Band and Jefferson Airplane. Actually, most of the groups that were not Warner Brothers acts got cut off.
The ones that got trimmed,
politics and pure corporate control.
Yeah, having said that, one of my questions was this, for both of you, really. The evolution of the music business, and specifically since we're talking festivals, you know, you had Monterey Pop and Woodstock and maybe Newport Folk Festival and Jazz Festival, but now festivals are huge corporate conglomerates, really. They're, a lot of them are being taken over by bigger festivals and such.
Yeah, most of them.
Is there a, how do you feel about festivals these days and playing them and the business of all of that?
Well, you go ahead, Skip.
Well, you know, there are more festivals worldwide right now than anywhere, and we try to play festivals whenever we can because there's not much more to do to organize and be ready to play a festival than there is to play a single night at a nightclub. And obviously, financially, it can be a lot more lucrative, as well as getting to play for a lot more people. In the world today, no band that I'm aware of has played more festivals than Canned Heat.
Really?
We've also played more motorcycle events than any other band, and we've played more charity events than any other band. We still believe in giving back, and whenever we can, we make deals with blues societies and other nonprofits to reduce our fee or donate back part of our fee or whatever. But the festival situation in the world is enormous today, and we just completed 3.5 weeks in Europe where we played 11 festivals and two clubs. And to play 11 festivals in 6 different countries all around Europe was not easy. We had 11 internal flights, but we were lucky enough to make them all, and nothing was canceled. And we had, while it was beating us up body-wise, and I'm sorry I did it to the band as far as physically, it was emotionally a wonderful thing, and we played for an awful lot of people in a lot of places. I mean, all the way from the Arctic Circle, where Sweden and Finland come together, at Flakkasand Rock and Blues, where the sun barely sets. It gets to the horizon at around 11 o'clock at night, and by 1 in the morning, it's up again.
Wow.
So, I mean, and the glow and the just an ideal kind of situation for a festival. And we played the largest jazz festival outside of New Orleans is in Pori, P-O-R-I, Finland, where they do 30 to 35,000 people a day. On the day that we played, they have some of the biggest stages. They have 4 stages, and people travel from all over Scandinavia to that festival every year because the lineup is so diverse. I mean, the day we played, it was Erykah Badu, Herbie Hancock, and closing the night was Brian Wilson, with a 50-piece orchestra playing the entire Pet Sounds album.
That's good company.
I mean, you don't find that kind of lineup in the U.S. even. You know, New Orleans has grown to be just the jazz festival to now it's the Jazz and Heritage Festival, and they have things that are, and people on the edge, whether it be Billy Joel or Paul Simon or Steely Dan. And fortunately, we're supposed to finally play there next year. We've never played. Mm. It's one of the few festivals in the world that we haven't played. So,
well, on your bucket
list. The festival thing keeps growing. You know, Live Nation is the largest concert controlling company in the world, and they continue to buy not only promoters but festivals. And right. they now own more festivals than anyone else. AEG is another company that's buying festivals. And, you know, you have the Coachella Festival. You have the classic East and West Festival, which is just like they've just done with three bands a day only. I'm involved with a company out of Phoenix where they're doing a thing called Boomer Fest next year. They're going to do it in Phoenix and Denver. It's 2 days. It's all acts that appeal to boomers. Rod Stewart, Santana, Crosby, Stills and Nash, Bonnie Raitt, that type of act.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to have other things that appeal to the boomers to lure them out of their house, where it's very hard to put a situation together where people want to go to these festivals. But this particular Boomer Fest is going to have a classic car show, a motorcycle show. They're doing 200 booths that appeal to people of the 50, 60-year-old bracket, which will talk to them about cruises, life insurance, health insurance,
hip replacement,
renting an RV, all of these right. other things that, you know, right. people still are involved in rock and roll. They grew up with these bands. They still want to see them under
maybe
an ideal condition.
Services.
Yeah, right.
You know.
Fido.
I wanted to jump in on something because you guys were asking about the festivals and Skip went on and on.
Right.
I want to jump in. I think you also wanted to know about the difference between those early festivals and now.
Right.
Yeah.
How has it changed for the musician? Yeah.
And the thing is that, of course, that kind of spirit and that kind of feeling of like the Monterey or the Woodstock Festival cannot be repeated, okay? They have tried, and they've done it. And as I said, the corporate taking over of music and rock and roll is just different. I mean, the festivals are fantastic, and they are very well organized and all that. But, as I said, the spirit of freedom and the spirit of love and peace and all that, that's not the same as it used to be. And it will never be able to, they'll never be able to repeat it.
Mm-hmm. Now, Fido, do you still enjoy playing, whether it's a really big festival or this, you know, event you have coming up here? The Ridgestock Festival is, needless to say, it's a smaller venue.
I love playing music, and the older we get, the more we love playing music. Not only we play all the time, but we play when we are off.
There you go.
I have jams in my house with all kinds of friends, professional and non-professional. We just play music for pleasure and for friendship. I also have a quartet with Larry Taylor that we rehearse every Thursday religiously with no gigs and no hope for the future or anything. We just play to play music. So coming to Syracuse and playing a nice festival there is going to be great. We love playing the music. Yeah. The music is still something that we all love doing so much. The problem is the traveling. The traveling
sure.
really gets to us because we're all guys and because traveling has become much more difficult now times. And
yeah.
That's why I always say the music is for free. We charge to get there.
You get paid to get there. Skip,
yeah,
I want
to... That's what I tell buyers all the time. You're not paying this band to play. They love to play. You're paying them to be a little more comfortable at 70 years old to get to these things and do their, not only their job, their fun, their work. You know, we're looking at Ridgestock. I think a guy named Professor Louis is there with the Chromatics, and I don't know that we've ever played with them. I've heard of these guys forever, and I think it might be the first time we've ever played with them.
Well, if it is, you're both going to enjoy sharing the stage and such. Professor Louis is a been around for a while. He worked with Levon Helm and the band, and they're made
a real upstate New York kind of
from Woodstock.
Regional
they
guy,
all live in
I
Woodstock,
think, you know.
And so you get that flavor. It's going to be very cool.
Fito, can I just ask you one last thing about music? You know, certainly people relate to Canned Heat because of the hits, and that song being on the commercial obviously brings that back to life. I mean, we're both boomers, Tom and I, so we go back at least 40-plus years with the music. What do you do now in terms of, you know, the songs that are more pop rock as opposed to blues, which has always been a foundation for the band?
Well, I mean, to us, it's something that we don't get touched by. I don't follow the pop scene or the current contemporary music thing. Mm-hmm. It really doesn't say anything to me. I try to be open-minded, and a couple of times I watch the Grammy Awards and all that. And to be honest, I saw a lot of young musicians trying very hard and doing their best, but I didn't see stuff that I'm looking in music for, like, for example, solos and improvisation, mm-hmm. which is something that we worked on so hard in the 60s. You know, most of the bands that play there, we used to have long jams and long guitar solos, bass solos, drum solos, sax solos, all this expression, you know, and all this improvisation. As I said, I see a lot of the current bands lacking that. And it's just part of the education and part of the music they've been listening to when they are young. And I see the music in general very stiff and very pre-programmed. And that to me is sad because I think blues music is very important because of that. And jazz, too. Jazz and blues should never disappear because those are the two truly cultural forms, American cultural forms, that represent feeling and improvisation.
Let me take that comment and what you were both talking about earlier about the festivals and the audience. And I'm wondering, what do you see from an audience when you're out there playing and connecting to them? And Skip, you mentioned the Boomer Festival, where a lot of folks are going to be familiar with all that kind of lineup. But are you touching, do you think, younger fans with this music? And do you think they're watching you and being educated?
Yes.
And hopefully developing a younger audience that will take this forward.
We talk about it too. You know, we talk about it on the interviews too. I say that there is still some hope out there. Not everybody is just doing disc jockey stuff. You know, there are kids out there working and playing in garages and developing their craft and their music, just like we did when we were kids. The problem is there is not that many of them. Okay. I don't know if they are going
to. The thing also that we do see, when I go to a festival, I walk around the audience. I walk through the audience before the band plays and actually interview people myself, trying to find out how they got there, why they're there, have they heard this band, do they have their CDs or records. And so many of the times lately, I get somebody going, oh yeah, this was my mom's favorite band, or this was the band my dad used to play the most, and I saw they're going to be in town, so I'm here. And so we do see people at the end of shows coming for autographs or coming to buy CDs that are 20 years old and are into this kind of music. And there is hope that it will continue, and it will, you know, elevate their musical taste as well. So,
oh, great.
Yeah.
Now,
you know, blues music will never disappear. It will never be very popular because it's not meant to be that. But it is not a trend. Blues music is a true cultural form, as I said earlier, and it will be around. There are plenty of blues festivals, plenty of blues bands, and there are young guys also playing that stuff, you know. That's good.
Sure. You guys are up for a blues award, right? A National Blues Award.
Well, we've won the Blues Hall of Fame awards. We've won those. But this year we're looking forward to maybe a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Blues Foundation. And now that they have a new CEO, Barbara Newman is there. She actually came to see the band last year mm-hmm. at in Chitango, which is very similar name in upstate New York, near the original Woodstock site. And she was there at that festival, and we got to meet her. And we're just hoping that, that this year, finally, we get a little bit of recognition from the Blues Foundation.
It will be well earned, for sure.
Yeah, well, very good. Yeah. Good luck to that. And, you know, welcome when you come up here. I hope everything goes well and travel is nice and smooth and the festival goes really well. Thank you guys for your time so much.
Well, maybe we'll see you up there, guys.
I'll be there for sure.
And all don't forget to boogie.
We will do that.
Very
Thanks,
good.
Guys.
Thanks again.
Right. Thank you.
Take care. Take care.